Hey, this is Evan Phillips from Anchorage, Alaska. You're listening to The Fern Line. Alaska, the highest concentration of big, remote mountains in North America. For generations, a unique group of climbers have tested themselves in these vast alpine arenas. The Chugach, St. Elias, the Hays, Neocola, the Kachatnas, the Revelations. Their stories are etched on high alpine walls. Their visions follow lines of cold gray ice. What inspires them? What makes them come back? Who survives? Who suffers? These are the stories we'll tell on Season 1 of The Fern Line. Hey friends, I'm Evan Phillips, and you're listening to The Fern Line, a podcast about the lives of mountain climbers. On Season 1, I'm chatting with alpinists and other outdoor enthusiasts who are pushing the limits of what's possible in Alaska's mountains and beyond. My goal is to have meaningful conversations with an extraordinary group of people, the folks who choose to live full-value lifestyles in one of the most beautiful regions on the planet. All right, well, it's so great to be back with you for another episode of The Fern Line. I can't tell you how proud and excited I am to drop the first episode of a two-part series with Jack Tackle today. Before we get into today's episode, I want to thank everyone who continues to support The Fern Line each month on Patreon. Patreon supporters get exclusive content, including Fern Line merch, original music I produce for the shows, as well as access to the bonus podcast, Beyond The Fern Line. But more than anything, when you pledge on Patreon, you're helping ensure that the podcast remains a viable and sustainable endeavor for me moving forward. So thanks so much for the help with that. Other ways you can help out are by leaving a review on iTunes or within your favorite podcast app, or you can just go the old-fashioned way and tell someone directly. Tell your friends, your coworkers, climbing partners, people you think might dig The Fern Line, let them know it's out there. And finally, if you want to reach out and say hello, please make sure and send me a note at thefernline@gmail.com. I love hearing from you guys. I love being part of a community that continues to grow every month. All right, so with that, it's time to grab your favorite beverage and get cozy on your couch or camp chair or work desk and settle in for this episode of The Fern Line.
Was always a very integral and important part that there was this, you know, element of trust and commitment and vision. Those are the three mantras I've always used to describe, you know, the essence of partnerships in the mountains and the essence of alpinism.
On episode 18, we'll delve into the first of a two-part series with venerable North American alpinist Jack Tackle. With his unmistakable baritone and classic unassuming style, Jack is the epitome of a true Alaskan hard man. His gutsy first ascents up climbs like the Isis Face on Denali, the Diamondarette on Mount Hunter, and the elevator shaft on Mount Johnson have cemented his place in the storied history of Alaskan alpinism. Recently, I got to sit down with Jack at his Castle Valley yurt to talk about his 40-year career as an alpinist and the lessons learned along the way. We discussed everything from his early forays in the woods to his most intense experiences in the mountains and in life. It was an enlightening and meaningful conversation that I felt privileged to be a part of. We started our conversation by talking about Jack's upbringing in Bozeman, Montana, and how a chance encounter in college led to a life defined by the mountains.
I grew up in Montana. Evan, I actually, grew up in Bozeman as a small kid. I did move around a lot. My father worked for the Forest Service, so he got transferred a lot. It was like, being in the military. But because he worked for the Forest Service, I grew up camping and hunting and fishing and being in the outdoors, a lot. But it had nothing to do with climbing. But it gave me an appreciation of, being outside and being self-sufficient in the mountains. But it didn't really click. I didn't go climbing, actually, until I was almost 20. And it happened right outside of Bozeman. So the foundation of it was just an appreciation of the outside that I got from my dad and growing up in Montana. I actually had a career, if you will. As a younger person, I was an athlete in organized athletics in school. I was average in a lot of things, but I did okay at football. And, once I got into my freshman year in college, I couldn't really do that anymore. And actually dropped out of college. I went to the University of Oregon. Dropped out of college when I was 19 and hit the road in a van for a year by myself. And two things that, have been significant seminal moments in my life happened on that trip. One was my father was in D.C. at that point, working for the Forest Service there. And there was this little thing going on called the Watergate hearings that I went to in person for 3 weeks because my dad got me a congressional pass. So I was in the room watching, all of Dean and Ehrlichman and Haldeman's and Mitchell's testimony, and I was there when Alexander Butterfield disclosed the existence of the White House tapes, which brought Nixon down. And the reason that's significant is because I'd gone to college thinking I might want to be an attorney. And since every one of those assholes was an attorney, I was, 19 and young and idealistic, and so right then and there I decided that law school wasn't going to happen. And plus I was, I was in the Vietnam era, so I had a draft number, and so I hated Nixon and everything else. Nixon's looking pretty good these days, but anyway, after I left D.C., I came back to Bozeman. I looked up some guys I'd gone to grade school with. I was headed back west, headed back to Oregon. And they asked me if I wanted to go rock climbing. And I went, sure, I didn't even know what a carabiner was. I had no exposure to it. So we went to this place west of Bozeman called Revenue Flats. And it just clicked. One day I knew, this is what I wanted to do. I had no idea how, what, or why I was going to be able to figure it out. And so it was sort of just by total chance that first day of climbing happened. So I went back to Oregon and pretended like I was trying to recommit to going to school and changed my major to business because I had this thought that I could figure out a way to make a living from the outdoor business, which actually wasn't even a phrase at that point in time. And all I really wanted to do was go climbing. So that's actually all I did initially and just started trying to figure things out. So, you know, some of the guys I learned to climb with in Oregon were more experienced than I was, and we started talking about, you know, bigger trips. And, you know, back then, you know, there was no sport climbing, there was no indoor gyms, there was, you know, there weren't cams, you know, Gore-Tex hadn't been invented. I mean, this was, you know, 1973. My first harness was a 1-inch piece of tubular webbing, 18 feet long, that you tied up the leg loops and then did a water knot at the waist, yeah. Which was fine, actually. But anyway, I started reading a lot about history of climbing and alpine climbing. I very early got interested in alpine, you know, mountaineering, technical mountaineering, as being the sort of culmination of all the different disciplines, you know, rock climbing and ice climbing and mountaineering and then alpinism, right? So for me, I think it was just because of that background of growing up in Montana. But it was also, it just was more interesting to me. And so I started trying to figure out how to learn about these different disciplines. And I moved back to Bozeman in 1975. And just south of Bozeman was this ice climbing place called Highlight. So I learned to ice climb there. And again, had that, you know, sort of these different venues and different opportunities to learn different types of climbing, you know, versus if I'd grown up in Oklahoma or something, you know. So it ended up that I, pretty early on, the first expedition I ever went on was in 1975 to Mount Waddington. And I'd only been climbing a year and a half when we went, and we failed miserably because we didn't really know what we were doing, and the weather was terrible besides. But it got me interested in this idea of exploring, going to remote big places, and trying to do something new that hadn't been done before.
It's interesting that you chose that as maybe your first kind of real mountain expedition. What was it about Mount Waddington that kind of drew you in?
Well, actually, I don't have any credit to why we went there because it was the other guys' idea. I didn't even know where it was. So some of the other guys that I met in Eugene, Oregon, at Oregon, it was their idea. But it had this history to them, and then I learned quickly about being this, you know, reasonably significant thing historically. Because, you know, Fritz Wiesner and Bill House did the first ascent in 1936, and then the next ascent was Fred Becky and his brother Helmy when they were 19 and 16, respectively.
And impressive.
Yeah, still impressive. And we wanted to do a route on the south face, which hadn't been done since Fred and his brother did it. And that was the draw. You know, it's remoteness, its historical significance, and the fact that, you know, that side of the mountain hadn't been climbed in decades when we went the first time. So I learned a lot that first trip about failure, which is really a good thing to learn about alpine climbing. And the next summer, I actually spent the summer in southeast Alaska with Fred and two other friends from Bozeman and learned a lot from Fred about how to stay alive in the mountains. And we did some, you know, some minor first ascents and spent, you know, the whole summer in the Juneau Ice Fields and the Chilkat Range near Haines, east of Glacier Bay and Fairweather. And then I went back in 77 to Waddington with a different fellow, Ken Kearns, who I ended up doing my first attempt on the ISIS face with, and we were successful. So we did this, you know, new route variation of the southwest, or the, you know, southwest face. We crossed paths on a few pitches with the routes that Fred and Fritz and Bill House had done. Actually found one of Bill House's pitons, which I still have, and found some manila rope anchors that Fred and his brother had left. But we were the first people to do it in 35 years. So that then became sort of like, oh, okay, so what's next, right? What can we do next, you know? And, you know, having been to Alaska the year before, it was Southeast Alaska, but it's not really the big mountains, right? So some of these same guys that I'd gone to Waddington with in 75, we decided we'd go to Mount Kennedy and try to do the North Ridge Alpine style. It had been done, but it had been done expedition, siege style, fixed ropes, and it's this amazing line, still is. One of the most classic alpine ridges in the world, I think. So I went there, we tried to do that, were unsuccessful, but we did some other minor first descents, and that opened my eyes to the bigger scale of Alaskan climbing. I mean, it's, you know, Mount Kennedy is not even in the United States, but it was, you know, we had to, we didn't have money to fly in, so we skied in all the way from the Alcan, all the way in, all the way out. Our primary objective, which was to alpine climb the North Ridge, didn't happen. But we did a 4,000-foot route on the east peak of Kennedy that was new, and a couple of other guys did some other peaks on the Kennedy Glacier that, you know, were there. But, you know, it's like, it's like doing something in the Tocosias instead of Denali. It wasn't really that big a deal. So anyways, that was 1978. And then 79, I thought, you know, the next step had to be to go to the Alaska Ridge. So that's when I went with Ken Kearns to try the ISIS face.
Having solidified their partnership on Waddington, Jack and Ken Kearns set their sights on the ISIS face of Denali, a hugely committing route that weaves its way up 7,000 feet of steep snow, ice, and mixed terrain. But after Ken was seriously injured in a fall, the climb quickly turned into a crucible of survival, commitment, and loyalty, lessons that would prove seminal for Jack in the coming years.
By that time, I'd gotten to know Brad Washburn a little bit and been, you know, like everyone else that was interested in the Alaska Range. If you wanted information and photographs, Brad was, you know, the ultimate resource. So I figured out what hadn't been climbed and started looking through the Alpine journals. And, you know, the access to information was totally different then, you know. You know, you'd go through the Alpine Journal physically, you know, in your house or at the library, and you'd read and look at the photos, and then you'd call up Brad at the Museum of in Boston and ask him if he had some photos or something, you know. It was, you know, compared to now, the access of information, you had to be, you know, a lot more diligent in terms of research, you know. And anyway, it just so happened there was this huge component of the southeast flank of Denali that hadn't been climbed. So it seemed like the next logical step after Kenny and I'd climbed Wannington, because that's who I'd climbed at South Face of Wannington with. So, you know, didn't go so well the first time, because it's a long story, but Kenny took a 250-foot leader fall and broke his femur, and it's a long chapter in a book that I haven't written yet.
Yeah.
But he survived. I was able to get him stabilized in that snow cave that we'd had. I down climbed a couple thousand feet, got to our skied out the West Fork, which was more dangerous than anything else I did, because we'd skied all the way up from the mountain house, roped, and, you know, I'm by myself. And Cliff Hudson flew over, it had flown us in, and had a CB radio. That, you know, I got a hold of Cliff, and he landed and got me out to Talkeetna. And then Mug Stump and Jim Logan, who were waiting to try the east face of the Moose's Tooth, volunteered to come back in with me and get Kenny, which is what happened, which was amazing. So we climbed back up to Kenny and put him in this Thompson litter, and Muggs ran the anchors, and Jim and I ran the litter, and we lowered him down the face, and Auchinleck came in his helicopter, because Jim hadn't bought K2 Aviation yet. He was just flying helicopters out of Talkeetna, and picked him up, and, you know, he went to the hospital in Anchorage, you know. So that was that was my first trip to the Alaska Range. So it didn't go so well, but, you know, I didn't have, obviously, near as traumatic event as Kenny, but...
Maybe just before you move on, talk a little bit about psychologically what that experience was like for you.
Well, you know, it was a traumatic event for Kenny. I just felt at the time it happened that, you know, it taught me, and I'd never had to address it as seriously as I did then to that point in my climbing career. But it taught me that, you know, you're responsible for the other person if something happens. And it's a commitment, you know, trust thing between partners. And so if, you know, shit goes bad, you know, you gotta step up, you know, and do what you can. So that's one thing I learned. It also taught me, you know, it was the first time I'd seen a real bad wreck in the mountains. It wasn't that bad because he didn't die, but, you know, it was a reality that I hadn't seen firsthand. But it was, you know, in hindsight, I could sort of dissect it and understand how and why it happened, and therefore how and why you could prevent it going forward. It was a life-changing event for Ken, because he never really alpine climbed again. For me, it started this legacy of having to go back to things in Alaska that I could never seem to get up things the first time. So that was an interesting process, which was, you know, recommitting to something that you'd have to try after failing. And so I think ISIS was pivotal for learning how to deal with failure, and also how to continue to try to hone your skills so you could make good decisions in the mountains. So I went back the next year with a fellow named Jim Kanzler. We didn't get any farther than Ken and I did because of bad weather. So that was a bust. The next year I went to China with the second American team that got to go into China after it opening up. And that was with Jim Danini and Kim Schmitz and Jim Kanzler to a peak called Mount Sugunyan. But then I came back to Alaska after the 81 trip to China with Dave Stutzman and finally finished off the ISIS climb successfully. So that was the first new route I did in the Alaska Range proper, even though it took me three tries. And it's sort of like a drug, you know. I mean, once you're successful, then you go, well, you know, let's do more. And another thing I think is important, you know, that I was lucky about was I just happened to be doing this stuff or be interested in that place at a time where there wasn't that many other people doing that kind of route, you know, development. It was just a, you know, a handful of people, Muggs, you know, Peter Metcalf, you know, a few people, you know, that I knew. But it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a big group of people. Most people were still just going to do what had already been done. And then also that same, Muggs and I talked about this. There wasn't any real reason. Why would you go do a second ascent of something if there were still all these new routes to do? It was, I mean, it's not maybe the best explanation, but it was at least how we were looking at it, at least myself for sure. I mean, I should have done the Moonflower because it's an amazing route, but he'd already done it, so, yeah. And there was all this other stuff. So Isis was important for a lot of reasons, like I just said, the whole epic with Kenny, but it turned out good. The, you know, the element of Muggs and Jim giving up their initial time and energy for their own objective to help me and Kenny out was also a seminal moment for me. And then having to go through the process of repeated attempts and then finally getting up it with Dave was important.
At the time when you did the ISIS face, were you scared when you went on it that last time?
No, actually I wasn't. The only time I remember being gripped was the first time I went there with Kenny in 79 and we skied around the corner, you know, having passed the north face of Huntington and finally got into that arm of the West Fork, and it was like, Jesus, you know, look at that. It's sort of big. Because I'd never stood on, and I know Kenny hadn't, neither of us had ever stood on anything that was that big, you know, just in terms of scale. And our plan, even with Stutzman, was to keep going, you know, to the top of Denali, which was, you know, miles and another 4,000 feet from the top of the face. So, you know, the scale in 1979 for sure was daunting.
Yeah.
It wasn't in 1982.
After climbing Isis in 1982, Jack took some time to explore other ranges, including the Himalaya. Although these were positive experiences, Alaskan mountains remained on Jack's mind, and in 1985, he and Jim Dineeny flew into the Alaska Range, intent on a new line up Mount Hunter. The ensuing climb, which they dubbed the Diamond Arete, would become an instant Alaska Range test piece, pushing the duo toward their mental and physical capacities. But more than anything, the climb created a bond between the two friends, which has now lasted over 30 years. I asked Jack to talk about his experience on the Diamond Arete and what his partnership with Jim Dineeny means to him after all this time.
In 1982, after ISIS, I had been, starting in 1977, involved in a retail store in Bozeman. First as an employee, and then later on as a part owner. And after ISIS in May of 82, I went back to Bozeman. One of the two stores I was part owner of wasn't doing well, and we closed it. So I didn't have a job. And when I went to China in 1981, I had gotten married, but when I got back, I wasn't married anymore. So I was single, and I went to work for Exxon, guiding in the Tetons for the first time that summer. So that was a significant thing. And then I got invited to go to the West Ridge of Everest the following spring. So I didn't go to Alaska the next year. I went and tried to climb the West Ridge direct without oxygen and without Sherpas with a big American team, which was a good experience. I got high. I was soloing high, but, you know, nobody summited. It taught me that I didn't want to be on big expeditions like that. Was, you know, there's like 12 climbers. It was, you know, big and complicated. But the ISIS thing also created a... And the fact that, you know, I wasn't as involved in the retail stores, I started looking for a way to make a living that was different than what I'd been doing. And, you know, sponsored climbing didn't really exist. So I got into the wholesale sales rep side of the business, having been connected with that, with the retail side. And this guy, Jim Denis, was a guy I'd met as a sales rep that came to my store in 1978 in Bozeman. All he wanted to do about the time he spent at the store was talk about this expedition he was going on to Pakistan to this thing called Latok One. And we just ended up, you know, doing business together, became friends. So, you know, I got through the ISIS phase, started working at Exxon, got invited to Everest, went to Everest the next spring. When I came back from that, I got an opportunity to go to work as a sales rep, as an associate for Danini, who was already an established rep. And that was a significant shift in terms of how I looked at a way to make money and a way to go climbing the way I wanted to go climbing. And again, the sponsorship thing really didn't exist. And for me, you know, I sort of stayed this way. I didn't really want some marketing department telling me where I was going to go climbing and who I was going to go climbing with. So I just decided to make money that way and do my trips the way I wanted to do them. And, you know, Alaska is not that expensive, and, you know, it's great climbing. And, you know, I went other places. I mean, I went to Pakistan the first time for me in 1984. So I also didn't go to Alaska that year and had a great experience in Pakistan. But I went back to Alaska in 85 with Danini, and we did the Diamond Arete on Hunter in that particular season. So, you know, I was bouncing around between the Himalayas and, you know, climbing all over the United States and doing a lot of winter climbing because it made sense to have those kind of skills so you could climb in Alaska because, you know, it turns out it's winter climbing even though it's past March 21st, usually. You know, what was great about the climb on Hunter with Jim on the Diamond Arete was we actually did get up at the first attempt. And we had a bit of a epic on the route from the standpoint of having to, you know, we dropped one rope that we both each still blame the other one for, and had a bit of a arduous descent with one rope and traversed the mountain actually all the way to Kilton Base because Hudson told us when he dropped us off one at a time in his Cub that he wouldn't come back and get us because he couldn't take off with weight from that tight little place. You know, this is long before people, you know, like Roderick started showing up with, you know, turbo beavers and turbo otters. So we were sort of committed. You know, we, the only way we were going to get out of there is if we climbed out of there. So that was great, actually. But it wasn't easy, you know. And it was Jim's first climbing trip to Alaska.
Wow.
Ever. He'd never been there to climb. He'd been there for business as the Patagonia rep, but he'd never been into the range until then. There were two or three things that stuck out. One was, you know, I actually took the first leader fall I ever took in the mountains on that route because I was trying to do this mixed pitch and the ice actually was super thin and it just calved off. I didn't fall that far, but that was, you know, a first. Not a big deal, but I just remember that. Above that is where we dropped the rope, which, you know, brought a new level of commitment to the whole scenario. And then on the descent, there were numerous things that happened that were not good. We tried to descend the northeast ridge, which the Japanese had done expedition style. And the snow conditions were so bad, we couldn't even go downhill. So we made this decision to just bail off the left side of the ridge looking, you know, down with our one rope. And it appeared that we could get to the Southeast Fork, you know, without too much problem. And we ended up having this epic descent down what is now called the Mini Moonflower. No one had ever climbed up it at that point. But that's how we got down. But it was much more technical terrain. We couldn't see all these cliff bends and, you know, the snow below us, we thought, just tied right into the Southeast Fork, and it was this huge serac that, you know, didn't connect to anything.
And you had a 60-meter rope?
Yeah, we had one 60-meter, 8.7 or something.
Jeez.
And so we started running out of gear, and I got hit in the head with a chunk of ice. You know, we didn't wear helmets ever in those days, so I got sort of clocked with this thing about the size of a grapefruit, and so I couldn't really go first anymore because I was too fucked up from that. And I ended up, you know, letting Jim take over, and we get down near the bottom, and you know, we got one knife blade left, one bugaboo, I think. And we had just enough rope if we tied it single to get down. So Jim ties off the rope to this tied-off bugaboo, and we wrap off. And we knew we needed a rope to get down the glacier, right? But we also just needed to get off. And we ended up having about 30 or 40 feet of extra rope we could cut off. And we get down, and we think we're home free. You know, we can see the planes landing and taking off at Gahill in the base, and then the snow conditions on the Southeast Fork were just horrendous. We couldn't walk because the post holing went up to your crotch every step, so we crawled sort of like Doug Scott on the Ogre. We crawled on our hands and knees for a long ways down the snow. It just wasn't exactly fast. But anyway, we're just like, fuck, we just, you know, there's the planes, they're, you know, it's flying weather, you know, it's this, I think this was like day 9 at this point. Of course, by the time we get there, the weather sucked in and we were stuck there for 4 days. So, you know, but, so there was a number of things that happened on that trip that were memorable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That sounds like a great climb and a great descent with one rope. Can you talk about, like, what was it? What did it mean for you to climb with a guy like Jim on a route like the Diamond Arete?
Well, Jim and I, you know, had already become friends before the 85 route on Hunter. But it's not uncommon for, you know, at least in my own experience, that, you know, and especially now looking back, that, you know, my best friends, with one exception, have been, you know, three or four of my strongest climbing partners. You know, unfortunately, a lot of them aren't around anymore. But for me, it was always a very integral and important part that there was this, you know, element of trust and commitment and vision. Those are the three mantras I've always used to describe, you know, the essence of partnerships in the mountains and the essence of alpinism. So that clicked, you know, with someone like Jim. It clicked with Kenny Kearns, but, you know, once he got hurt, you know, it ended his alpine climbing career. And so Jim and I are still best of friends. He was just here last week. I know exactly where he's camped in Indian Creek. You know, we've been friends for half of his life and more than half of my life. So that hunter climb, though, sort of cemented that. So that's, again, a really great benefit and I think an amazing part of climbing that, you know, you have these foundational climbs and time together that then forge these, you know, friendships and partnerships way beyond just tying into the rope.
There I was on the highway, looking back over my shoulder to the country.
After their success on the Diamond Arete, Jack and Jim continued their partnership throughout the 80s, working and climbing together whenever possible. In 1991, the team headed back to the Alaska Range, this time to the steep, unclimbed Cobra Pillar on Mount Barril. It was in this new alpine arena that Jack's mantra of commitment, vision, and trust would refine itself, and a whole new realm of possibilities opened up.
You got nothing in your way but your own reflection. The bitterness from your path gives way to the open wide.
Well, Jim's a really good rock climber, and he was always a much better rock climber than I. And, you know, he and I both went, you know, after all these other types of routes in Alaska that involved, you know, crampons and ice tools, maybe we should just go rock climbing. So that looked like a really, just an interesting, cool objective. You know, it had Andy Ogler had done one route on the entire east face of Barril at that point, was to the right, and I saw this crack system in the middle of this pillar that, you know, just happened to have the right light on it, and then we started looking at it, and it was just this splitter crack that went up the middle of this pillar. I was like, well, look at that. And there was nothing more to it than that. It just looked like an aesthetic line. And I figured, you know, I had Danini to lead the hard pitches, and the crux is this 511 off with. You know, here we are in Alaska climbing in rock shoes with chuck bags, you know, barehanded. It was fun. But it really just had to do, again, with the line. You know, there was the aesthetics of the line. It was unclimbed. So, you know, I've said this, you know, many times, but for me, I'm not, you know, I played a little music. I was okay at sports. But, you know, for me, creatively, you know, the only thing I've actually, you know, been sort of okay at was climbing. And, you know, I viewed these big expanses on a side of a mountain as a sort of a blank canvas, you know. I'm not the first person to use that analogy, but I really did look at it that way early on, you know, because you could create this thing that no one else had done before. And, you know, once it was done, you know, no one could take that away from you.
Yeah.
It's a pretty, you know, unique experience. And, you know, people have the same feeling about putting up, you know, a 60-foot sport route, you know. But for me, you know, it seemed like this, you know, like the scale of something like ISIS, you know, I just was like, Jesus, you know, this is sort of an amazing piece of terrain, and wouldn't it be cool to figure out a way through it?
Yeah.
So climbing for me has always been interesting in that respect from a psychological standpoint of problem solving. That's all climbing is problem solving. You know, if it's already been done, different, you know. There's no doubt it'll go. So the Cobra Pillar was just a rock climb. I mean, it's, Jim picked it, you know, in that book, 50 Favorite Climbs. You know, if he hadn't gotten interviewed first by Mark, you know, I might have picked it, but I had to pick another route because he'd already beaten me to it. So it was nice to have just an enjoyable, fun climb, you know, that took 45 minutes to descend from the top back to our tent at the mountain house.
Wow.
You know, we just walked down these steps that were already there, and,
wow,
you know, we didn't do a single rappel and just walked off, went back to the tent.
You did the elevator shaft in the mid-90s, correct?
Yeah, I tried it first with a guy named Kim Miller in 91, I believe. And we got caught in a storm, and it is a really bad place to be when it snows. So we got trapped for a day underneath the first chalk stone because of the spindrift avalanches, and then we just had to wait for it to stop snowing.
Were you, like, literally just, like, hiding under the chalk stone?
We were literally underneath this chalk stone for 24 hours. Wow. Just this funnel of snow that was like a blast furnace went on for a day. Because at that point, it's only about, I don't know, 8-10 feet wide, and you got this accumulation zone the size of Delaware, you know, that feeds it. So it's like you can't be there if it's bad weather. So I went back the following year with Bill Belcourt, and we never even went on it because there was a 30-foot cornice on top of the shaft. We got involved in a rescue and a bunch of fatalities and a bunch of other shit, but we didn't even go on it. So I did go back with Doug Chabot, which was the first climb I did with Doug, I believe in 94. And it was great. You know, most climbers that have spent some time in the mountains and they're doing, you know, kind of climbing that leads you to think that you could do something like the elevator shaft, you know, technical proficiency isn't really the issue. It's conditions, weather, and psych, you know. So all three of those things lined up perfectly.
Yeah.
And, you know, Doug and I just lounged on top of Mount Johnson for hours in weather like this, which was, you know, again, unusual, you know. And then the peak had only been climbed once by the backside route that we descended. The East Ridge had been attempted numerous times. It still hasn't been climbed.
Yeah.
But it was great. And everything, again, things just lined up, you know. And for some reason, there's a couple of routes that haven't had second ascents. Most of the ones I've done have had second ascents. But that one hasn't for some reason.
It's cool for me to chat with you about all of this stuff because you did the elevator shaft when I was probably 20 or something, and that's kind of when I had the fire and I was, you know, really getting an alpine climb. But I remember I lived down at my family's cabin at that time. It was on the Kenai Peninsula in Ninilchik. I had a subscription to Climbing Magazine, and there was nothing to do back then, so I would just wait for that magazine to show up, and I would just read it cover to cover. But I remember looking at the picture. Is you get to the top of the elevator shaft, and then you go up a little bit, and there's just this headwall with a perfect splitter going up it. And I have a vivid memory of that picture and just being like, oh my God, it looks so perfect. It really does sound like, in so many ways, everything just came together for that climb.
Yeah, you know, I'd, like ISIS, I'd put some time and effort into it already, so I had some knowledge. It's such a cool looking line, you know. You know, you don't have to be Fellini to figure out where the route ought to go, you know. So it's a pretty unique gash, you know, because in some places it's like 150 feet deep into this monolithic rock wall, you know. It's pretty wild. But the head wall you just spoke about, Evan, is actually, it was terrible rock initially. The rock isn't famous for being stellar, especially farther down the gorge on Johnson. But it was manageable. But it was like climbing around here in the desert in the old days. You'd look at a knife blade crack on some, you know, like a core putting up a aid route or something. And you wouldn't take a knife blade out. You'd take out a 3-inch angle, right? Wail on it. And it's sort of what we did on the first pitch of this head wall, because it was like cracker jacks, you know, this decomposing shitty granite with the crack. But it was sort of a seam, and so it was just creative climbing initially, and then the rest of it was like 5'7" in plastic boots, you know. It was easy. So anyway, it was fun, you know. I think it took us 5 hours to descend the backside to what's called the Backside Glacier, and we'd already arranged with Auchinneck, and he just came and picked us up there. We didn't even have to go around to the gorge.
Nailed it.
And he came in and got Doug and took him out to Talkeetna, and he came back and got me, and we flew around to our camp, got out, you know, 100 feet from the tent, threw all our shit in the back of the plane, and went out. It was great.
By the mid-1990s, Jack had established himself as one of the major forces in Alaska range climbing. His first ascents on Denali, Hunter, Johnson, and Brill are still considered modern-day classics by many. But as much as Jack loved the Alaska range, he'd never forgot about his experience on Mount Kennedy in Kluane National Park almost 20 years before. So when his old buddy Jack Roberts asked him to attempt the North Ridge in 1995, Tackle simply couldn't refuse.
So after the elevator shaft, Chabot and I did a new route on the southwest face of Hunter that we called the Sound of Freedom. And I started looking at, you know, other projects in the range. But I got a little sidetracked in 95 because Jack Roberts called me up and asked if I'd ever thought about climbing Mount Kennedy. And he didn't know of my history having been there in, you know, 17 years before that. So we went into Kennedy in 95, again, with the idea of trying to still do a yet unclimbed alpine-style ascent of the North Ridge. And, you know, we failed because of weather and conditions. But we also, you know, it was interesting, the perspective of 17 years prior versus then, you know, the Spart had evolved as far as, you know, harder grades of ice climbing and mixed climbing had become much more sophisticated, and the grades had gone up, and also just the compilation of looking at something as big and complex as the north face of Kennedy to the right of the ridge you know, it never even remotely entered my mind in 1978 that you should go out there. But in 95, when Jack and I were there the first time, here's this huge unclimbed face, huge, you know, and beautiful, you know, and it looked sort of hard. So we came back in 96 and climbed the face. You know, we did it capsule style with a portal edge until 3,000 feet up. And a bunch of, you know, interesting things happened, like I dropped one of my crampons. And when we got stuck below the summit, having connected with the North Ridge, so we'd done the new aspect of the climbing of the face, but we didn't go to the summit because of avalanche danger. And we wrapped the North Ridge, you know, with, in my case, one crampon, which was not ideal. But we had a great climb, even though we didn't summit. So I got sort of attracted to the Logan St. Elias Range again, even though I'd been there before. I'd actually been to ISIS the first time, because I saw in that perspective of that 17, 18 years difference, all this potential, and nobody was there, and big, big things.
Yeah.
Right? And I think I remember the year Jack and I did Kennedy, which, just as an aside, has two root names, just because Jack and I could never agree about anything. So it's referred to as both Arctic Discipline, which was my name, but Para Jacks was his name, and that sort of stuck because it was clever. Anyway,
they're both great names.
Yeah, I think both of them are good. I agree. At any rate, I started looking around Logan again and other aspects of the Logan St. Elias complex. And I got sort of fixated on the southeast face of Logan, which was the largest unclimbed face in North America. Bigger than ISIS, you know, and higher elevation than ISIS as far as the face, top of the face. And remote as shit, you know, like, I think the park statistics for the year in 96 for the Kewaunee Park was there were 120 climbers that went there in the entire season.
In the whole park?
In the whole range. And a lot of those were skiers, you know, that yeah. had to register. And 70 of them were on Logan.
Yeah.
And 95% of those 70 Logan climbers were on either the Trench or the East Ridge.
Yeah.
So you got this thing that's twice the size of Switzerland with like 40 people trying to do real climbs. It's still that way, actually. So I got sidetracked from the Alaska Range proper. But again, as I've said, which is politically incorrect, it's all Alaska to me. It just happens to be Canada.
Yeah.
But I mean, the mountains are the environment, the type of climbing is, you know, it's all similar to the Alaska Range.
So the southeast face of, is it Logan?
Yeah.
Did you actually climb that?
No, I wish the hell I had.
Yeah.
No, I climbed the East Ridge with JoJo and my girlfriend at the time, Jeannie Wall, with the idea that JoJo and I would go around and try it, but we ended up we ran out of time because of storms.
Yeah.
So I went there with Jack the following year, and we had perfect weather, perfect conditions, but Jack wasn't into it, to be honest.
Yeah.
I'm sure we would have got up at that year because of the conditions, and, you know, we both knew how to climb. And we'd been successful in Kennedy, you know, just right before that. So that was unfortunate. But I went back with Jay Smith and Fabrizio Zangrilli in 2007 and tried it again and had horrible conditions. And then the word got out in Jumbo, and it was a very strong Japanese climber. He and his partner actually climbed it the next year, got the PLADR, and went exactly the way that I knew the route went.
Yeah.
So it was sort of one that got away, you know, that's the way it goes.
Well, thanks for hanging out with me today. I hope you got as much out of Jack's stories as I did, and I hope you can apply some of his immense alpine wisdom to your next trip in the mountains. Make sure and check out part 2 of the Jack Tackle series, which comes out Friday, December 15th. If you dig the podcast, please consider making a financial contribution each month on Patreon, and don't forget to leave a review on iTunes or within your favorite podcast app. And finally, if you enjoy the tunes you hear, you can get more of my music on iTunes, Bandcamp, Spotify, and evanphillips.net. Until next time, I'm Evan Phillips, and this is The Fern Line.